We've been studying the book of Isaiah, which we return to tonight, for over 2 years now. I guess approaching three, really. I was counting up this week, and I have preached nearly 50 messages in the 10 chapters that we have covered. And in some ways, to me, as I was reflecting on it this week, I feel like we've really flown through the material that's there. We have been introduced to history, the doctrine of God and of sin at a level that I think most of us were unfamiliar with before we started this study. And it's been an amazing kaleidoscope of truth, I think, that dazzles our minds and spirits and leaves us with a sense of amazement as we reflect on these profound visions that Isaiah had. All of it sort of came to a crescendo, you may remember, as we've gone through this in chapter 9, particularly verses 2 through 7, and the promise of a coming day of light with a child who would be that light and would establish his government of peace after a time of gloom and despair that Israel suffered because of her sin. That section wasn't the end of Isaiah's message, but it certainly has been the pinnacle so far. And it forms for us at one and the same time both the core and center of everything that Isaiah says and also the boundaries within which he says everything that he has to say. It is the first and the last of his message, the beginning and the end. In fact, the glorious hope of chapter 9 is set in stark contrast to the remainder of that chapter, where there is an ominous message of the finality of God's judgment for the northern kingdom. A section where you may remember the prophet repeatedly calls out with a sonorous tone, "In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away and his hand is still stretched out," four times, driving home the seriousness with which God deals with sin. But it's not coincidental, I think, that it falls directly in the shadows of the greatest message of hope that he has given throughout the entire book, the message about the Prince of Peace. You remember that great section I referenced it there, 2 through 7, with the great promise, "Unto us a child will be born, unto us a son will be given, the government will rest on his shoulders, his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, and there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace." You know, in reality, all of Isaiah's message, all of his prophecy walks a fine line between those two truths, the hope of the glorious child who's coming and the darkness of God's judgment. He walks a fine line upholding God's unfathomable wrath towards sinfulness that we have seen in graphic and poetically beautiful ways, and then God's unfathomable mercy towards sinners. That's why this book, I think, has held such fascination and adoration for believers down through the ages. Because those two things are revealed in some of the most profound language you'll find anywhere. Isaiah's message is this, that God is at work in both visible and invisible ways. God's work in His providence is often seen in the immediate, sometimes in His judgment against sin, while at the same time, through that judgment, He is working out a plan to fulfill His promises, a plan that maintains hope and maintains His covenant. God has both a visible plan and a time that it, and also a plan that at times seems invisible. And Isaiah's message really throughout these entire chapters is that we should not ignore either one. To ignore one would be to deny that the character of God that's revealed in that, whether it be in His present judgment and the hatred of sin that it shows and reveals His justice, or whether it be His purpose in purging and cleansing and preparing a people to whom He promises restoration. God is working both of those plans side by side, sometimes with the same actions. He is working both judgment and restoration. He is working both hatred of sin and love for His people, sometimes through the same action. Chapter 10 carries on that theme in the clearest way. You may remember at the end of His message of judgment, God's hand is still stretched out. He says there, verse 4, He begins in verse 5 presenting a passage with penetrating insight into the sovereignty of God and the affairs of men. It's a section really that pushes the limits of our understanding, I think, of the world. It does mine anyway. Because it's a picture of the Assyrian army, the drumbeat of whose boots has been in the background of everything that we've read so far as they are approaching Israel. And we read, or we have read, a number of times about their cruelty, about their pride and corruption, about the vileness of their sin. And yet we have twice read in chapters 5 and in chapter 7 about how God whistles for them from afar. We've read that in their cruelty, they're actually doing the bidding of God. Chapter 10 spells that out more clearly than ever before. It's more than just an instance of God taking advantage of an opportune moment. This is not God merely seizing upon the ambition and the plans of a wicked nation. This is very clearly God raising up this nation for this purpose. And Isaiah completely presents the Assyrians as doing God's bidding. The only power they have is the power that God has given them. We saw that in verses 5 and 6. He says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation." And God is actually presented as using them as His rod. But even more than that, He's presented as arming them, as giving them their weapons. And their weapons, He says, are His indignation. God was the reason for their success in their wicked endeavors. God was the one who endowed them with the power to accomplish that wickedness. The staff in which they used to accomplish it was His indignation. Every wicked and cruel and torturous campaign in which they succeeded by God's power. And this wasn't just some short-lived temporary success. This was, you understand, generation after generation after generation of Assyrian kings who reigned in cruelty, all the while operating with God's indignation as their staff. We're not to draw the wrong impression of this, however, because in verse 7, Isaiah tells us, yet it does not so intend, that is, Assyria doesn't intend to do the bidding of God. It does not so intend, he said, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather its purpose is to destroy and to cut off many nations. God is not ignorant of that. He is not ignorant of what their motive is. He knows that their motive is not to do His bidding. He knows that Assyria is not planning to be His instrument in their hearts. And as a choice of their own wills, they plan wickedness. They plan cruelty. They plan self-exaltation. They plan pride. In fact, you can read in verses 8 through 11, as we did last time, about all of their boastful claims. That's what was in their heart. It wasn't to do the Lord's bidding. And yet, despite all their evil motives, everything that they were planning in their own pride regardless of their aim of exalting themselves, God was using them. Now, they were completely culpable. They were completely accountable for all of their actions. Every evil intention that they planned in their hearts, they would be held account for. One day there would be no excuse for any of it. There would be no forgiveness when they died in their pride and arrogance. And yet their wickedness was doing God's will and His bidding by His power. I told you last time, this is nothing more than the theology of Joseph. Remember Joseph in Genesis 50:20, where he sees his brothers and he says this really profound statement to them. They had sold him into slavery, you may remember, as an act of their jealousy and pride. And Joseph meets them in Genesis 50:20 and he says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." See, God had prophesied long ago that He was going to send the descendants of Abraham down into Egypt for captivity for 400 years. He had spelled it out. And it wasn't as though God was just making the best of a bad situation and responding the best way He could to the evil plans of Joseph's brothers and taking something that was bad and turning it around to good. That's not just what Joseph was saying. He was indicating that God worked through the evil actions to accomplish exactly what God wanted to do. God had already ordained it. And in the case of Assyria, as soon as He was finished with them, no matter what their plans were, God would bring upon them judgment for every evil decision they made. You know, I think we sometimes view God as though He were just adjusting to and working around the evil actions of the world. As though He is the responder. As though He's always on His heels and having to catch up with the free exercise of man's will in pursuing evil. But Isaiah's message is that God is using, indeed God is ordaining, and giving success to the evil decisions of Assyria. And yet it happens in a way that doesn't abolish Assyria's guilt for their decision, nor does it imply guilt with God. Assyria will, in fact, come under judgment for every wicked act, even the ones they accomplished in God's purposes. And as soon as He's finished with them, as soon as His work is accomplished, He says there in verse 12, "So it will be that when the Lord has completed all His work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, He will say, 'I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria.'" Because of his pomp and his pride that's described in verses 13 through 15, we see the devastating judgment of God from verses 16 to 19. That is, in many ways, the visible work of God. That is what was easily seen. Maybe not this profound picture of God's sovereignty working through the free decisions of wicked men, but at least it was obvious that He was bringing judgment against Israel, His wrath against their sin. It was the clear fulfillment of all the warnings that Isaiah had given. And it's fairly easy to see that work of God. But there's another part of the plan here, one that is not so visible, not so apparent. It's a plan whose thread really has been woven all the way through the tapestry of Isaiah's message from the beginning. And it's the plan for a remnant. It is His plan not only to preserve, but to purify a remnant of godly Jews who will embody all the hope of the promises of God that were given in the covenants. Isaiah 10:20, we see Isaiah returning to the theme of the remnant. And he says, after everything he said about Assyria and all of their pride and all of God's using them, he says in verse 20, "Now in that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel." After explaining really what was going on visibly with the Assyrians, he reminds them of really a less visible work of God, something God was just as equally accomplishing through the Assyrians. It was first introduced all the way back over in chapter 1, verse 9, when we first read about God's anger and judgment against Israel's sin. And it's that section ends in verse 9. It says, "Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom, we would be like Gomorrah." That is, totally destroyed. It's reiterated throughout the chapters, but then over in chapter 6, verse 13, we saw that great picture when he says, after all of his destruction, after cities are devastated and left without inhabitants, houses without people, he says in verse 13, "There will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains in it when it's felled. The holy seed is in its stump." And here, again, the idea of the remnant. And he has the idea, he has a picture of God chopping down Israel as a tree. And then after he's chopped them down, subjects them again to burning. And so just judgment upon judgment upon judgment. That's the idea. It's not good enough just to chop it down and have the stump left over. Then you burn the stump. And yet he says, despite all that, there still is somewhere at the heart, at the root, at the very core of that stump, there still is something left which God will raise up again. That's the remnant. In chapter 10, verse 20, we receive the fullest treatment of this doctrine that we've received thus far. And again, it's no coincidence, really, that this is given to us now in the lingering glow of the sovereign glory of God through His plan with Assyria. We now see another plan, not just the judgment of sin, but God's plan of preparing a remnant. In fact, Isaiah is intentionally directing the minds of the Jews to this truth, because in the midst of their suffering under the Assyrian threat, the Jews were supposed to clearly understand what was visibly going on. They were experiencing the judgment of God. God was bringing real judgment against their sin. And yet at the same time, and by the same means, God was working out a plan of blessing for this remnant. He says there in verse 21, "A remnant will return, a remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For through your people, O Israel, for though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness." Isaiah paints a picture here of this suffering. Once again, it is both God's judgment and His blessing, and He lays a theological foundation, really, for the Jews to better understand what's going on and to give thanks to God for this invasion. Now, as we look at the passage, I want you to note two encouragements, two words of encouragement, really, that Isaiah has given the people here. Two words of encouragement that they are to focus on during their time of suffering. He wanted them, first of all, to understand the purpose of this suffering, but also the promise beyond the suffering. You see, first of all, this purpose that he lays out in verses 20 and 21, he reminds them that this suffering has a purpose beyond God's judgment of sin. And he spells it out there. He says, "In that day," basically, that's a short phrase that means the day of God's visitation. It's not literally a single day. It's a time period. It's a phrase that we've already seen a number of times all the way throughout Isaiah. It's a phrase that describes when God visits His people in a manifest way with His power or His presence. That day. In fact, turn over to chapter 3, verse 18. We read then of the coming devastation and destruction. It says, "In that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, their headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils," and on and on and on. He's talking about the devastation of Jerusalem and how God would take away from the daughters of Zion who walked proudly in all of their adornment. He would take away all of those things and leave them, in verse 24, with a belt, instead of a belt, a rope, instead of well-set hair, a plucked out scalp, instead of clothes, the donning of sackcloth, a day of mourning, a day of grieving. So that day would be a day of grief, a great day of judgment. And even in chapter 4, verse 1, "For seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, 'We will eat of our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name, take away our reproach.'" He's not talking about every woman in Israel on a single day going after married men. He's talking about the characterization of this coming time period. This coming period of time when they would be so devastated. There would be such a decimation of the male population that seven women will go pleading after one man saying, "Listen, you don't need to even provide for us. We will provide for ourselves, we'll work for our own food, just let us have the honor of being married." But then interestingly, in verse 2 of chapter 4, there's another picture. "In that day," he says, "the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. The fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. It will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of the Mount of Zion, over her assemblies, a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy." So you get this picture of not devastation, not gloom, but actually beautiful adornment and promise and glory. And this all happens on that day. It's really a phrase, the day, that must be defined by its context. To say that day really just describes the day of God's visitation. It doesn't describe a particular event. It doesn't describe a particular 24-hour day. It describes a day of God's visitation, and it must be defined by the context. Back over in Isaiah chapter 10. In these particular verses, it's obvious from the context that the day he's talking about is the day of the return of a remnant, because he says that. He says in verse 21, "A remnant will return." It doesn't say from where they're returning. It doesn't even say how long they'll be gone. It's clear this day hasn't come. It's describing a condition that doesn't currently exist. But it's describing a day of the remnant's return. That's important because the language in these verses gives us some more clues about when this day happens. It's connected to the idea of the Assyrian invasion because of the promise there in verse 20 that in that day they will never again rely on the one who struck them. So whatever you can say about that day, it's the day in which Israel will never again turn to someone like Assyria. They will never again rely on Assyria for security and strength. In fact, they'll never rely on any foreign power or any foreign god ever again. Because in fact, their heart will be changed. In that day, they will see the foolishness of their former ways and they'll forsake them. It's one of the things that God is accomplishing through this work, through His judgment through Assyria. He's accomplishing this work of purifying them. And their heart is changed, you see there at the end of verse 20. They will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. Emeth is the word in Hebrew. It's a rare word. It just simply speaks of something that is genuine, something that is true. It had always been Israel's claim that they were God's people. They sang songs, they offered sacrifices, but all of that was just in pretense. Because as Isaiah has shown us, though they boasted in their confidence in the Lord, when it came down to it, their real trust was not in God. It was in the Assyrians. We've seen that a number of times. In fact, we've reflected on in our own lives how easy it is for us to say we trust in the Lord and still to put our trust in the schemes and devices of men. Our lives really sometimes look no different than the lives of unbelievers. We have lots of spiritual language, but we turn to the same devices in which they find security. Our real trust is, as Isaiah said in chapter 2, verse 22, it is in man whose breath of life is in his nostrils. In other words, all of mankind, all of his institutions, all of his schemes may appear to have great security, but they're no better than his own fragile mortal life. So Israel's trust up to this point had just been in words. They certainly were not willing to take any risks that would cause them turmoil in their trust of the Lord. And so while they were saying they trusted God, they would seek real security in some scheme or some treaty with a foreign power like Assyria. And there in verse 20, Assyria, which was the staff on which they leaned or relied on, one way to translate that, they leaned on it or relied on it. God says that staff has become a rod, and that rod struck them. How many times have we seen that picture of sin throughout this great book? That's the nature of sin. It's the nature of the idols that we repeatedly turn to. We lean on them, we put our trust in them, only to find out that they, though they promise security and joy, they only deliver pain and brokenness. There's coming a day, though, he says, when Israel will not be like this anymore. A day when they will be true. A day when they will be sincere and genuine, when their hope in the Lord will be true. And that day, he says, will only be for a remnant, a small fraction of those who make up Israel. He calls them there in verse 20, the remnant of Israel, the ones from the house of Jacob who have escaped. And again, in verse 21, the remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob. And then down in verse 22, only a remnant within them will return. Four times in those three verses, driving home that fact. It's interesting. Verse 21, a remnant will return. That is, in Hebrew, Shir Yashub. Now, some of you very astute listeners and Bible scholars will recognize that. That's the name of Isaiah's son. Shir Yashub, all the way back over in chapter 7. I think it was in verse 3. The Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son, Shir Yashub." Isaiah had a son, and his name was Shir Yashub. Shir, a remnant. Yashub will return. A remnant will return. That's the name of his son. And that's the word that he uses here. But interestingly there, at the end of that verse, he mentions another child that he's already made reference to. He says, "A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the Mighty One, El Gibor." We've seen that word already too, because it's over in chapter 9, verse 6. "The son who's born to us will have names, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God." Same word, El Gibor. I believe it's the only two times Isaiah uses this in his entire book. So you have the remnant returning to El Gibor, the day of the child, the day of the promised Prince of Peace. So in a way, Isaiah really is tying together all of these great prophecies that we've been looking at so far. Once again, he's speaking of the remnant that will return that he's mentioned a number of times, and he's tying it to the time of El Gibor. And we begin to pick up clues about this day now that Isaiah is referring to. It's a day when they're going to return. It's a day when they will return with sincerity and trust. And yet it's a day that seems to reach at least as far as the day of the Prince of Peace. This then isn't just talking about the invasion of Assyria. This isn't a reference just simply to a few people escaping this coming judgment. You know, and as we reflect on this, and we think about the history of Israel, we understand that's exactly what Isaiah is doing. He's not simply referring to the Assyrian invasion now. He's laying out a doctrine for which every Jew, no matter what their circumstances, could reflect on and find hope. It wasn't immediately after the Assyrian invasion when Sennacherib surrounded Hezekiah in Jerusalem. It wasn't immediately after that that Israel repented and put their whole trust in God, never to turn away to foreign gods or foreign idols. In fact, there would be more chastisement. There would be the Babylonians, and then there would eventually be the Romans who would level their cities and tear down their temple. Up through all of those invasions, Israel still would not turn wholeheartedly to the Lord. They still would be idolatrous and worldly minded. Still, their hearts and minds would not completely, sincerely trust in the Lord. And this prophecy of the remnant then, as we've seen in other places, it continues to look forward. It continues to look past even the Assyrian invasion. And yet, Assyria was a part of it. That's why he brings it up right now. The Assyrian invasion was a part of the lesson that the Lord would teach to Israel. It was a part of His plan in preparing the groundwork for this remnant. The work of turning Israel's heart back to the Lord was not just one chastisement. It wasn't just two. It wasn't just one invasion. It wasn't just two. It wasn't just a captivity here, an occupation there. It was the work of repeated judgment and chastisement, one after the other, one after the other, and yet God never forsaking His promises to them. This was the remnant that one day will return, one day will be true to God. That's actually where Isaiah points them, remembering that there's a purpose, but then there's a promise. He says in verse 22, "Though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant will return." A remnant within them will return, excuse me. "A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness." You can probably recognize that phrase in verse 22, "Though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea." That was the phrase that God used with Abraham. I think it was in Genesis 13:16, where he makes reference to Abraham's children being as the sands of the sea. And then later on over in Genesis chapter 22, where in the sacrifice of his son, as Abraham showed his willingness and obedience, God reiterates his promise once again and promises that he'll have children as the sands of the sea. And then once again, over in Genesis 32, he says the same thing to Jacob. Excuse me, to Isaac. God is saying to Israel, indeed, the promise is to Abraham and his descendants that they would be as the sand of the sea, as the sands of the sea. And Israel by this time was a great nation. There were many of them. And yet they would be rejected. Even though they represent that multitude of people, God still would not give them all the promises of Abraham, because it wasn't the multiplication of them physically that was necessary. It was the preparation in their hearts. Not only multiplying outwardly, but repenting inwardly. Not only being physical descendants of Abraham, but being spiritual descendants. And so the multitude of Israel would be rejected, he says in verse 22, and only a remnant will return, because only a remnant would accept the Lord. John Calvin captures this meaning here, I think, very well. He says that the posterity of Abraham would be like the sand of the sea did not apply to a promiscuous multitude which had apostatized from godliness, but that there would be a kind of interruption in a corrupt nation till shortly afterwards it should be renewed. He's right. God would sort of wipe out this multitude and he would start over with a remnant, with just a remnant. God wanted them to understand that all of this judgment doesn't cancel out his promises, nor his faithfulness. It ran contrary to God's nature to forget those promises, but it also ran contrary to his nature to fulfill his promises in a rebellious people. And so he says there at the end of verse 22, a destruction is determined. It is decreed, ordained in God's plan. But you'll notice there at the end, it's a destruction that is overflowing with righteousness. What's the result of all this? The result of the Assyrian invasion and the result of the judgment through Assyria will be that God is preparing the way for a righteous remnant. Once again, Calvin, I think, has a great, great quote here. He says, this consumption will be sufficient to fill the whole world with righteousness. The remnant which shall survive it, though small, will be sufficient to cause such rivers of righteousness to flow that the whole world will be overflowed by them. God is preparing a work. He's doing something through this Assyrian invasion that is not only judging sin in the present, but which is working to fulfill His promise in the future. That's what he's saying. God has a plan. And the plan has a present aspect of judging, and it also has a future aspect of fulfilling His promises. And He's working out that plan even through this. It's interesting. Paul actually quotes this verse over in Romans chapter 9. You can flip over there for a minute. Romans chapter 9. I don't want to say fast approaching this in Sunday school. We are creeping up on these verses in Sunday school. Paul quotes this verse. He says there in 9:27, Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be like the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved. For the Lord will execute His word on the earth thoroughly and quickly. That's a reference to His promises, and that He will not delay. See, because Paul was writing in the context of a group of people who still had not seen those promises. And God's faithfulness was being questioned. And he points back and he refers to what Isaiah taught, this theology of Isaiah. And he quotes this verse to validate God's promises, to validate what God is doing. Because God had made a promise to Israel that through the Assyrian invasion, God would bring a remnant. And Paul, in his own day, was realizing that they were still waiting. They were still waiting for God to complete His work through the remnant. This reference that Isaiah makes isn't something just for the Assyrian invasion. He wasn't talking about just a few people that would survive that. He was not talking about just a few people that would survive the Babylonian captivity. He wasn't even talking about just a few people that would survive the Roman decimation. This is a doctrine which has played itself out in Israel's history even to today. Paul was dealing with the fact here that Israel still didn't believe. And his answer here is not to redefine God's promises. It's not to say, oh, no, you don't understand what God meant when He made those promises. No. He does what Isaiah does. He reaffirms the promise, but points out, just as Isaiah pointed out, that it is playing itself out through the remnant. And the day still awaits. Paul will talk about it in Romans chapter 11, when it all will be fulfilled. All of God's promises fulfilled in His kingdom. God is working His plan. He works His plan in ways sometimes that are very visible. We see His plan. We see His hand at work. And yet in ways that are invisible. He's using the wicked motives of men now to fulfill all of His plan. In your life and in my life, to His glory and to our good, He uses even the plans of wicked men. And at times it may be difficult to see His plan and His promises being worked out. But they never fail. God's promises never fail, even when they're less than visible. That's the message of Isaiah. In the dark days of the invasion, in the days of chastisement, in the days of gloom, trust Him. Trust Him. It's not profound, really. It's not unheard of. It seems rather simple. And yet how difficult it is for us to remember that. How difficult it is when we are facing the wicked who are prospering. And we wonder why. We see the Assyrians rising up. We see the proud and the boastful rising up. And we see their efforts seemingly blessed by God when ours are frustrated. God is working out His plan. He's working out His plan in discipline for your life, but also His plan of promise. Everything He's ever promised to you will not be thwarted. Neither by the pride and the choices of the wicked, nor even by your own failures. His promises don't fail. That's the message. His promises do not fail. They never do. And He will bring them to pass in His time and in His way. Let's stand together. We'll be dismissed with a word of prayer. Father, we reflect once again on this great passage, and Lord, we could never begin to take it all in. Just to ponder the really unbelievable truth of what You were doing through a wicked nation like Assyria. Indeed, Lord, You reign over all, in every action that takes place is within Your sovereign will. You raise up kings and You bring them down to establish Your own purposes. Lord, I pray that we would grasp that truth, lest our trust in Your sovereignty be shaken by the advance of the wicked. And yet at the same time, Lord, help us to trust that though the days may seem dark at times, Your blessings seem so far away, that Your promises never fail, that You always bring them to pass, and that even in this time, You're using all of those circumstances to prepare us for that day, purifying us, preparing us, teaching us for a day in which Your glory will be seen throughout the earth. Lord, give us the trust that You called Your people Israel to. Give us a trust in You, in Your character. And Lord, we will glory in You until that final day. It's in Your great name we pray. Amen.